This is the hymn, Be Still My Soul, that touched young Moses profoundly as a lad, so deeply that he wanted nothing else in life than to sing such songs from his very own heart. And the hymn itself must have given him courage while he moved through his life on his way to his goal. In the words of the song, bearing patiently, with hope, things he didn't understand until he found his voice. The final line of the hymn, in fact, proclaims an even greater voice, the voice of the Lord. And the stillness of the title comes, no doubt, for Moses, now grown, from the centering of his magnificent voice in the voice of his heavenly friend. Again, words from the hymn. As we hear this story from Moses Andrade, we might take note of two interesting footnotes. The ensemble performing here is the all-boy English vocal group Libera. They take their name from the Libera Me of the Requiem Mass, meaning deliver me or free me. The singers range in age from 7 to 16. And what is unsettling is that when Moses was their age, even younger, he was shut out of choirs and choral groups because of the sound of his voice. His voice was so low that choral directors didn't know what to do with him. He didn't fit in. Another irony is that the tune for Be Still My Soul comes from composer Jean Sibelius and his tone poem Finlandia, and the chorale-like, hymn-like section. Finlandia itself written in the context of his country's struggle for freedom and independence. So we'll soon be hearing about the power of music on many levels as we continue. In that light, we are invited to attend a concert of opera, art, song, and spirituals this Sunday, June 8th at 3 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church of Wilkes-Barre, featuring M. Moses Andrade, basso, and pastor of the Wyoming Valley SDA Church, and Brian Farrell, pianist, opera conductor and producer, and music educator from northeastern Pennsylvania. Moses and Brian paid a visit to the WVIA Banco studio to talk about the concert program and to tell us how their lives have come together so that they're able to share music they love with others. Brian Farrell.
I grew up here, went to Wyoming Seminary, and worked with Mr. Vita. We called him Mr. Vita, John Vita, Sr. And then went to Juilliard, got 2 degrees from Juilliard, bachelor's and master's degree from Juilliard in piano. But I quickly fell in love with opera at Juilliard, which was kind of an unexpected twist. I didn't think I would fall in love with opera. I would go to the Met every chance I got, and I got a job at a Juilliard Opera Theater, playing piano for all their rehearsals and stuff like that. Then moved to L.A. and got a job with Domingo at L.A. Opera as an assistant conductor, rehearsal pianist, and just loved opera. Then started my own opera company in L.A., nonprofit opera company. We just do local productions, and with me at the piano, and I had a stage director that I worked with, and incredible amount of local singers in Los Angeles who were just wonderful opera singers, and they would work for free. They just loved to do it. So we did 47 operas from the years like 2003 is when we started to when COVID hit in 2020. We were about to do Girl of the Golden West, and everybody got shut down, so that was our final. Then we had a shutdown after that. And that's when I moved back here in 2020 because of COVID, and then met Moses right after that and fell in love with this voice. How could you not? And begged him to do some opera with me, to do a concert or at least do a few performances. But that's kind of where this concert is coming from, is my falling in love with this voice and his musicianship, his incredible, unique sound that he is able to deliver.
Do you think you would have fallen in love with opera had you not been able to go to the Metropolitan Opera and hear and
see
that?
That's a great point. I think you're right. Yeah, I think because I was exposed. Well, Juilliard had an incredible opera program. They had the Juilliard Opera. Back then it was called JOT, Juilliard Opera Theater. Then it became the JOC, Juilliard Opera Center, while I was there. And it attracted literally some of the greatest young singers in the world at the time. And I got a chance to play for them. They'd be hanging out on the fourth floor of Juilliard. And they would call me in, hey, Brian, come and play this scene for us. And I just was just in heaven, just in heaven. Because, you know, as a pianist at Juilliard, your day was basically you alone in a room with a piano practicing hours and hours on Chopin etudes and Liszt and Beethoven. And as much as I love that music, at a certain point, you start to lose your mind being alone, like in solitary confinement in prison or something. You know, I just had a hard time with that. So I was always finding myself going to the Opera Center, hanging out with the singers. They were much more fun than the, no offense, than the pianists, the other pianists who were kind of just in their own little worlds. But the opera singers were just larger than life, personalities, big personalities. And I had a blast. And learning all the repertoire, learning the arias, learning the scenes, learning the languages, Italian especially. And once you start learning all that stuff, then you become more in demand because the singers know, hey, he knows how to play my aria, or he knows how to play my scene. So come, we'll pay you. Let's go. So I made, you know, a living back then, paid my rent, playing for opera companies back in New York in the 90s, and fell in love with it.
And Moses, we began by learning that you grew up as a little one and your mom heard you in the nursery and she knew you were hungry because your voice was lower than the other hungry children. Where did you grow up? And tell us about that experience of having such a rich voice when you were just a little guy.
I grew up in Jamaica, in Kingston, the capital city, and you're sent to school very early, to prep school, preparatory school. You begin to learn grammar and concord after the British style and so forth. But I was sent to a Nazarene school. It was a Nazarene prep school, so we had worship every morning, and that's where I started to hear these beautiful lyrics of hymns, and I thought, I like that. And my heart, like John Wesley, was strangely warmed. So I would try to go to church. I got myself to church to hear more of it. All I ever wanted to do in my life was to sing hymns. I had no other aspiration. I just wanted to be in church to sing those beautiful hymns. The first one I can remember was Finlandia, Be Still My Soul. And it still gets me, yeah. So going to school and then not making it into any of the choirs, I figured that was just life, but I kept trying in the bathroom, you know, and getting chuckles here and there. And then my voice changed when I was 13. And that made it even more complicated because I couldn't sing the baritone stuff. Even though I was so young, I could not handle it. So I would just practice by myself, kept trying. And I would draw pictures of what I thought the voice was, the lungs. I'd make constructs to try to understand what do I do, how do I breathe. I had no insight. I just kept trying. And I remember taking the Bible and putting my throat on it, my neck, and saying, I don't know what to do, you gotta help me. Everybody laughs, but my heart wants to do this. So it would take years until I came to the United States, finally went to college, and I was studying theology, art, and Bible languages to a minor, and I got called by Dr. Bingham. Someone said, he wants to see you. I said, for what? He's a music director. He said, you are what we call a basso profundo. I don't even know what that is. So he told me that I was to be in the choir, and I obeyed. That was where I started to get shaped.
When you heard basso profundo, you are obviously someone who would want to investigate that. Did you make the connection with the Orthodox liturgy or those Russians at all?
Oh, right. Yeah, he explained that. He said, you will be my first 32-foot pipe. And I didn't know what that was either until we were doing Gretchaninov, and there was a low B flat below deep C, and I anchored it without effort, and that was it.
And how did that feel then, finally to have found someone who recognized your gift?
Freedom. I wasn't stuck trying to keep squawking. And I did not even have a middle C, you know, a C4. And I worked, though, because he said, now I want you to develop. And I go, like, do I have to? Now that I've found this. So he said, I'm going to pay for a semester of voice lessons for you. And he did. He put me on a scholarship because of the goodness of his heart. And it was Mark Evans. He was a tenor. He was one of the sweetest person I ever met. Very gentle, kind, and understanding about what I was going through. And he started to vocalize me up to E flat, F, above C4. And I said, what am I doing there? He said, don't worry about it. Just do it. And then he said, we'll work on the bottom one day, but you already have that. So he vocalized me right down to like a E flat below deep C.
And what did that open up for you to be able to sing then?
Well, I started to get more solos and money. And he told me, I want you to go to Boston University School of Music for an audition. And I thought, what now? So I went because I was obedient and naive. And I met people that I didn't know who they were until years later. Phyllis Curtin, gorgeous woman even then. And then there was Richard Cassily, a mountain of a man, a tenor. And he told me again, he said, you're what we refer to as a basso profundo. So I auditioned a few pieces, which didn't go well, in my opinion. I think it was as nervous, and I didn't have the technique. And they said, we still want to offer you a scholarship. You would make it on the Met. And I didn't know what the Met was either. So I thought about it, and I said to him, I wrote them a letter saying, this is very kind of you. I cannot accept it. What about church? I kept saying, I don't know. What do I do with opera and church? So I just never pursued it.
You did follow your heart, though, as far as the church.
Yeah, it's, you know, pastoral work for a while, but music was always saying, so I yielded to that more and more until I met very kind people, very patient people.
What happened then when you came to Wilkes-Barre?
That was 2017 when I was called here. And met a lady in Aldi, and I was doing my usual stuff, just trying to be gracious. I said to the cashier, oh, you're so good at what you do, and da-da-da-da. The lady came beside me, and she said, what a voice. And I said, well, thank you, and I left. And she followed me outside, and she said, we need you in our choir. And I thought, I don't think I have the time. What is your name? What's your number? And that was John Vida's choir at First Press, and then the rest happened.
You know, I like to play for First Presbyterian Church, where John Vida Sr. is musical director, off and on for Sunday morning service. So it was August, I believe, of 2021. I was playing for the service, and I hear this voice in the choir, this voice. And I'm like, this is not usual for a local choir. I thought, did Reverend Zanicki hire a basso from the Metropolitan Opera to sing in his choir? But, you know, that would require a lot of money to hire somebody of that caliber. So then, of course, I met Moses, and I said, we have to do opera together. Whether you like it or not, we have to do some opera. And he told me he did do some opera, but not that much. So I thought it would be a great experience to explore this great repertoire and try out different arias, scenes, maybe try some art song, spirituals, all kinds of stuff. Just incredible bass repertoire that we could explore together.
Well, he's really good at what he does. So I always feel confident, not only with his playing, but his coaching. And people say, oh, I heard you doing that Italian piece. I said, yeah, I mimic well. So what I do is I have a fairly decent ear with inflection, so if he says to do it this way, I just...
Well, in all fairness, I mean, a lot of singers don't speak Italian. If to sing, you don't have to necessarily speak Italian to sing in Italian. It helps, of course, but, you know, studying the diction, studying the elocution, that's the secret to it.
So what did you do, Boris Godunov? When you think of the bass arias in opera, what are some of the great ones?
Well, the ones we're doing Il Lacerato Spirito from Simon Boccanegra by Verdi. We're doing Vecchia Zimara from La Bohème, Puccini. We're doing
Ernani,
Infelice from Ernani, another Verdi.
Guno,
yeah, Vuki Fett from Faust, Guno, yeah. The devil aria, you know, the big famous bass, where he has to laugh on a high G, so that'll be fun.
Me
And finally, we're doing a really cool aria from the opera Susanna by Carlyle Floyd. Blitch's aria.
The preacher.
I'm a lonely man, yeah. Susanna. Yes. Yeah, wonderful aria.
So you make up for the devil because you're the preacher.
Yeah, yeah. He's a preacher and the devil. Yeah. You know, just a nice variety from American literature, Italian, French,
British,
you know.
English, through Vaughan Williams, the art songs.
And then the art
songs of travel.
Four of them from Songs of Travel. Originally, they were written for baritone, but we brought some of the keys down to just kind of make it more comfortable and more correct for his voice.
Stevenson's poetry, yeah.
Yeah, Robert Louis Stevenson's poetry. And then second half is going to be more of a sacred group of songs, the famous aria from Handel Messiah, But Who May Abide, and then
Moses Hogan from his compendium of spirituals. Brian can tell you more about him.
He was an African-American composer, conductor, pianist, and just did these incredible arrangements of the spirituals, of the African-American spirituals. So, you know, the only real arrangements that existed before Moses Hogan, besides some isolated ones, was Burley. The famous Henry Burley arrangements, which were wonderful but very simplistic, you know, just simple chords. But he did a companion of pretty much all of them. But Moses Hogan comes along and does these just incredibly gorgeous pianistic arrangements with a lot of unique harmonies and, I don't want to say difficult piano parts, but much more elaborate and colorful.
Emotionally
deep arrangements that just will tear your heart out when you hear them because they're just so incredible. So I'm really excited to do these three Moses Hogan arrangements, you know, because the spirituals are already very just emotionally deep works, right? They're into the American history. But when you hear what Moses Hogan did, I remember the first time I played them years ago, I was just blown away by the harmonic colors and the textures of the arpeggios and stuff that he would do in the piano part. And this voice just marries perfectly with that type of arrangement. So I'm really excited to do those.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
And of course, we have a couple pieces from the pen of Aaron Copland, you know, which is to America, I humbly say this, what Vaughan Williams did for for British mm-hmm. music.
Yeah, it's two songs from the old American song sets. He wrote two sets, and this is from the second set, from I think it's from the early 1950s. And again, just like the Moses Hogan, they're not original tunes. They're arrangements of folk songs, basically. And the two we're doing are At the River, which is a hymn from the early 1800s, and we're doing Zion's Walls, which is a shaker melody, a really joyful, fun shaker melody. And Copland sets it in this really kind of contrapuntal way with a lot of interesting key changes, you know, completely different from the original simple melody. So you hear Copland take it and kind of add his magic to it. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
So that's a wide range, though. You have to inhabit a lot of different characters and scenes and times in that program.
Well, I think that's what makes a fun and amazing recital, is to have this variety of genre spanning the centuries, from Baroque all the way to modern styles, composers, languages. I think it makes the audience just really always sort of connected to what's happening. So if you're getting bored in one song or one style, boom, it's going to change in a few minutes. So mm-hmm. I think that's important, especially in our modern era where everybody is on their cell phones and they can only last maybe 30 seconds before they get bored. So it's, here it's only a couple minutes.
Yeah. What about storytelling in music? The opera is story in music, the songs of travel, stories in music. You must have fallen in love with that as a pianist, right?
Well, the story of Songs of Travel, I mean, we were just talking about this last night, even with my parents. We performed for them just to get a sense of what it's like, especially the last song. It was not the last song of the cycle, but it's the last song we're going to do, Whither Must I Wander, the poem by Robert Louis Stevenson that Vaughan Williams sets so masterfully and so perfectly. And it's all about memories of what your childhood was like. You go to your childhood home and you see that it's empty now, but you're looking at it, and in your mind are your parents and your family members and your siblings, and you're remembering from years and years and years ago. And it's just, you can barely not start breaking down, you know, when you start thinking about it. And then Vaughan Williams, these just lush emotional harmonies that he puts underneath this incredible poetry. You know, the first time we rehearsed it, we both were in tears.
Yeah,
we couldn't even get through it.
I told him, we need to take this one out, because I said, I don't want to be blubbering in front of the people.
Right.
I'm not going to make it. Because he brings it, I call it, to a resolution in the very end. As he said, this man is reminiscing. He said, spring shall come again, calling up the moorfowl, you know, the cycles of the seasons. But in the end, he goes, the chimney stone is cold. There's no one there to light the fire anymore. But birds come and cry there and twitter in the chimney. But I go forever and come again no more. So there's no more cycling for me. Once I go, there's no resurrection, so to speak, at that point. He said, I go and come again no more. So that was very palpable for me. And I said to Brian, I don't think I'm going to make it. Let's take this one out. So
yeah, and I don't think there's a human being alive who can't relate to that. Yeah. As you get older and you look back and you look at, you know, where you grew up and you think, oh my gosh, all the when I was a kid, I did this here and I did that there and I went to church there. I ate dinner there. And it's just, you know, you just can't. The emotions that it brings up, you know, and then Vaughan Williams, of course, goes with that. And it's hard. Even now, if we were to perform it, I have a hard time not just really breaking down in the middle of it.
He brings it to you. Vaughan Williams brings it to you and with no apology. This is what I want. Mm-hmm. This is what I envisioned. Mm-hmm. This is what I want you to evoke from my music. And you can't do any less. It takes everything. It requires, at least for me, I have to position myself, center myself before I begin and, you know, make peace with the emotions and then just go into it and be the vessel. Because people are sitting there waiting.
Yeah, they want to feel it.
I want them to have everything I can give at that moment.
Yeah. Well, I had a professor at Juilliard, Jerome Lowenthal, who used to say, you have to get all of that out of your system in the weeks leading up to the performance, where you cry and you feel, so that when you're on stage, you're just the conduit. And the audience can feel. Because if you're up there blubbering, we're not going to get it. We need you to be the medium of it, you know. So that's our challenge this week, is to get all the blubbering out of our system.
You understand? I have to be true to the music and to the composer as much as I can. And the people, the people sitting there, they're part of the music. And I would never think I did them right if they came just to say, oh, we want to see Moses. No, I wanted to participate emotionally. I may be up there as one of the conduits, but I do not want to be central.
It's an emotional journey. I think that's the key to it. You know, trying to find ways of going from joyful to sad to maybe some anger, like, but who may abide? It's kind of got a angry tone from the Bible, you know what I mean? But then it goes to the joyful sounds of Zion's walls.
Sublime.
To then the three spirituals, of course, just dredge up the pain of American slavery and all of the emotion that goes with that and the history of that. You know, so there's just so much. And again, trying to always keep the listener engaged so that you're never bored. So hopefully nobody will be bored in the middle of it.
Well, we actually interspersed a little history, a synopsis, very brief.
Yeah.
So that people are not just going like, well, what is this?
Yeah, especially in the opera. I like to just say maybe a minute of what you're going to hear, who the character is. I try to connect with the audience so they can understand what's going to happen. You know, what is the devil talking about when he's laughing? You know, that sort of thing.
You used the word freedom when I asked you about what it was like when someone finally recognized your gift and gave it a name. But you've continued to work on your technique and your interpretation. And you're now at the point, are you, of relaxing into that freedom? To use your voice to move us?
I've always tended to be more of a demure type of person. Not quite that way anymore. So we sang this verse at his request at Harvest Assembly. First 20 minutes, I was wondering to myself, I wonder how this is going over. And I couldn't see well because it's lit. It's a nice stage for presentation of large dramatic scenes or biblical scenes. After 20 minutes, I thought, I like this. I like this feeling. I like being on the stage. And I don't remember ever feeling that way except, let me just sing and get off. I stood there after that, and I thought, I felt my feet plant in that way that you're supposed to. And then all of a sudden, it just relaxed, and I saw that the people's hands in and out of the darkness. Okay, this is good. And I thought, I do like this. I like this. And I can't say that enough. It really is for the people. Mm-hmm. There's nothing more important than the folk who come in. You know, they work hard. They've just lost someone. They may never, ever go to New York City to even see the edifice, the structure of the Metropolitan Opera. Whatever we can do to bring something uplifting, I think is a calling.
M. Moses Andrade, basso, and Brian Farrell, pianist, speaking with us in anticipation of a concert program this Sunday, June 8th at 3 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church of Wilkes-Barre, 97 South Franklin Street. Admission is free and a reception will follow. On the program, as we heard, there will be arias from Italian, French, and American operas, Verdi, Gounod, Puccini, and Carlisle Floyd, four songs from The Songs of Travel by Ray Vaughan Williams, setting poetry by Robert Louis Stevenson. There will be four sacred songs, But Who May Abide from Handel's Messiah, Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, and Aaron Copland, two songs, At the River and Walls of Zion. Then this tune, Sometimes I Feel, one of three spiritual arrangements by Moses Hogan.
Always, from home.
a concert of opera, art, song, and spirituals featuring basso M. Moses Andrade and pianist Brian Farrell on Sunday, June 8th at 3 in the afternoon at the First Presbyterian Church, 97 South Franklin Street in Wilkes-Barre. For more information, fpc-wb.org, fpc-wb.org, and they show us here that there will be a YouTube live stream, and you can find that and the details at fpc-wb.org. A concert of opera, art, song, and spirituals with M. Moses Andrade and Brian Farrell, Sunday, June 8th at 3 in the afternoon. Admission is free. First Presbyterian Church, 97 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre, fpc-wb.org.